I want to depart from the usual theme for this series on the JFK assassination by looking at the evidence against Oswald. One of the things that historians debate from time to time is how do we get through to the public the overwhelming evidence against Lee Harvey Oswald? Do we try to create a two-minute video? Do we try to create a podcast of 30 minutes? What about a podcast of an hour? How about a podcast of 3 minutes or a video of 3 minutes? Perhaps that will achieve the magic effect of making people aware of the cold, hard evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald shot JFK and only Lee Harvey Oswald. It is true that it is almost impossible to prove a negative. However, that is really a myth. There are many ways in which you can prove that something was not done. For example, in a crime, one can produce an alibi that proves that person A did not commit the crime because person A was unable to commit the crime since person A has an alibi. So it is possible in certain respects, in certain situations, to prove the negative, whatever the negative happens to be. But when one tries to posit the difficulty of disproving a massive conspiracy that supposedly lurks behind every corner, then it's almost impossible to get somebody who was convinced of the unlikely and the improbable to believe in the overwhelming evidence that proves just the opposite, namely, in this case, that Oswald alone killed President Kennedy. So maybe it is a fool's errand to try to find a particular venue or a particular modality to use to prove what has been proven for more than 60 years. But let's try one more time with this little audio podcast and trace the actions of Oswald from Thursday, November 21st, to the next day, November 22nd. That's not a long time. And because of the enormous research conducted by the Warren Commission, we have a great deal of information on what Oswald was doing, and his own actions incriminated him. It's almost like a camera was following Oswald around. We have so much detail and knowledge of almost every step he took. Now, in the morning of Thursday, November 21st, Oswald had a huge breakfast at the restaurant outside his boarding house, which was very uncharacteristic of him. Evidently, he was celebrating something. He was spending an inordinate amount of money on a breakfast, which usually he would not spare more than just barest coinage to finance. But on November 21st, he really partied that breakfast. And then he headed out to Dallas to the Texas School Book Depository building. Later that morning, he collared Buell Frazier. Frazier was his ride to Irving. And, of course, Oswald rode with Frazier every Friday, or almost every Friday, to spend the weekend with his wife, Marina, who was living with Ruth Payne at Ruth Payne's home in the suburb of Irving. Well, on Thursday, Oswald approached Buell Frazier, and he asked Frazier for something he had never asked before, and that was a ride to Irving on a Thursday. Now, this surprised Frazier because, again, that had never happened before. And Frazier said, well, why do you want to go out to Irving on a Thursday? I'll be happy to drive you, but why do you want to go on a Thursday? And Oswald said, oh, I need curtain rods for my rooming house. And so Frazier, who was very agreeable, said, well, that's fine. I'll drive you out to Irving anytime you want. Frazier lived in Irving, so he drove to Irving every night. So that afternoon, Oswald and Frazier did ride out to Irving. Now, this was a total surprise to Ruth Payne and Marina. Obviously, as I said, Oswald never did this before, and he did not tell Marina in advance that he was coming out there. He said nothing to her about curtain rods or anything else for that matter. And Marina actually apologized to Ruth on the spot for Oswald's sudden uninvited appearance. But Ruth waved the apology away, as Ruth was in her sweet, nice way, and Ruth said, "That's okay, it's fine." And both women thought that Oswald had come out to Irving early because he had fought with Marina the previous Monday over a phone call that had been made on Sunday to Oswald's boarding house. Ruth Payne had the telephone number for Oswald's boarding house, something Oswald had forgotten. And on Sunday evening, Ruth dialed the telephone number because Marina had the idea that her daughter June ought to speak to her father on the phone, since Ruth had the telephone number. So they called the boarding house, and Ruth asked for Lee Oswald. Well, the person on the other end of the phone said that there was no one by that name there, and that totally flummoxed Ruth. And she said, "Well, are you sure? Is this the number that I dialed?" And he said, "Yes, that's the number, but there's no Lee Oswald here." What had happened was that Oswald had registered at that boarding house under the name O.H. Lee, and he had forgotten that when he gave the number to Ruth. At any rate, the next day, when Oswald called Irving to speak to Marina, as he did every afternoon, Marina said, "Why were you not at the boarding house when we called? In fact, they said, you don't even live there." Oswald said, "Oh, I registered under a different name, O.H. Lee." And Marina really had a fit at that point. She said, "Why are all these comedies happening? Why is all this foolishness going on? What's the purpose of all these silly fake names and so on?" That made Oswald mad, and he said he did not want the FBI to know where he was. And he furthermore ordered Marina, as we've said in a previous podcast, to destroy the telephone number in Ruth's notebook. Now, we know why Oswald was so upset, because 2 days earlier, on Saturday, November 16th, he had first learned that the presidential motorcade would go by the building where he worked, the Texas School Book Depository building. So from Saturday, November 16th, to Monday, November 18th, when he was speaking to Marina, he was all excited because the president would be within reach if he could only smuggle his rifle, which was in Ruth Payne's garage, into the Texas School Book Depository on November the 22nd, when the motorcade was scheduled to go by. Now, suddenly, his plans were deeply, deeply threatened because he knew that the FBI was on his trail, and the only comfort he took was from the knowledge that the FBI did not know where he lived. They did not know the address of the boarding house. But suddenly, on November 18th, Oswald became aware that he had done a stupid thing, that he had given Ruth Payne the telephone number to his boarding house, and that if the FBI returned to Irving — they'd already been there twice that month — if they returned to Irving between November 18th and November 22nd, they would find out where Oswald lived. Oswald also had left a threatening note with the FBI sometime between November 5th and November 12th. We don't know the exact nature of the threat, but this gave Oswald good reason to fear that the FBI was looking for him, possibly planning to arrest him. So it's no wonder that Oswald was furious at Marina. No wonder that he ordered Marina to tell Ruth, or to destroy the reference in Ruth's notebook, whether Ruth wanted to do that or not. Well, Marina added fuel to the fire by refusing Oswald's order. She said, "No, I'm not going to do that. That's Ruth's private property." And so Oswald hurled an obscenity at Marina, and Marina hung up the phone. So when Oswald came out to Irving on Thursday, November 21st, both Ruth and Marina thought that this was setting up an apology, that Oswald couldn't stand it anymore, and that he wanted to apologize to Marina. And in fact, Oswald did act like he was very apologetic to Marina. But we've seen in the case of Oswald's time in New Orleans that he was perfectly capable of manipulating Marina and of lying to her on several occasions, letting the faucets flow with crocodile tears, as when he told Marina that he wanted to go back with her to Russia as a means of manipulating her to renew her request to the Russian embassy that she be granted a visa to leave the country with June in tow, but not with Oswald. So Oswald, I think, was manipulating Marina once again by pretending to apologize to her, when of course his real motive for going to Irving was to collect his rifle, which was in Ruth Payne's garage. Now, of course, Ruth Payne did not know the rifle was there. There are so many tragic coincidences that allowed the assassination to take place. One of them was that Marina did not tell Ruth that Oswald's rifle was being stored in her garage. Ruth, with two children, would never have allowed a rifle in her garage, and Marina knew about the rifle but didn't tell her. And Marina, of course, was too frightened to object to the rifle in the garage. So when Oswald went out to Irving, Ruth didn't know why he was there except to possibly apologize to Marina. And Marina had forgotten all about the rifle, so she believed the apology story as well. It is true that Oswald apologized to Marina three times and begged her to go with him and move into an apartment as soon as possible, where the new child and June and Marina could join him, living independently of Ruth. But the problem was that Marina did not want to leave Ruth's house, since the atmosphere was so much better than any living conditions she had experienced with Oswald. In my opinion, Oswald was just play-acting. He did not want Marina, the one person who knew what he was capable of doing with his rifle, to connect his visit with the presidential visit that was happening the next day. Marina knew that Oswald had a penchant for targeting political officials with his rifle. He had done so more than once and actually had taken a shot once, namely Edwin Walker, on April 10th. So if Marina thought a bit about the presidential visit, Marina would have had to connect that visit with a motorcade that she didn't know anything about because she could not read English. And then she would have had to connect the motorcade to the Texas Book Depository building, the location of which she had no idea, and she had no way of believing or no reason to believe that it was on the motorcade route. So it's asking a lot of Marina for her to connect Oswald with Kennedy's visit, especially when she knew that Oswald did not have a car and had no reason to suspect that he was there to get the rifle. However, it's not a stretch to think that she might have made something of a connection if she had thought long and hard enough about the presidential visit. Oswald's repeated requests that he move with her to an apartment suggested that Oswald had no plans to assassinate President Kennedy. And I think that's what Oswald was trying to plant in Marina's head, an insurance policy against her possibly connecting his visit to Irving with the presidential visit the next day. At any rate, Oswald did go into the garage. He did collect his rifle, which was disassembled, and he put it into the package that he had made himself from the paper materials at the book depository, probably earlier that day. The next morning, Oswald left his wedding ring in a precious teacup, a precious Russian teacup that Marina had kept, and he also left hundreds of dollars for Marina to use in his absence. He only kept to himself a little more than $13, hardly enough to go to Mexico City, but enough to make his way around Dallas, as if his plan involved not only shooting the president, but perhaps taking another shot at Edwin Walker before surrendering. This is the supposition of the newsman Albert Newman, and I agree with that theory. So the next morning, Oswald told Marina to stay in bed. He secretly left his wedding ring, which suggests that he was going to do something sensational, at least end his marriage for good. And he also left Marina the vast remnant of his remaining resources, keeping for himself a measly $13.80 or so. Oswald then left the house with his jerry-built package and went to the home a few doors down of Lily Mae Randall, who was the sister of Buell Frazier. Frazier was in his sister's kitchen when the sister noticed Oswald staring into the window, which Oswald had never done before. And this frightened Lily Mae. And Frazier noticed Oswald out there, and he was startled a bit, but he said, "Oh, that's Lee." So he left the house, and Oswald had already put his package in the back seat, because the car was unlocked, of course. And so Frazier got in the car, but Frazier noticed the package on the back seat. And he asked Lee, "Lee, what's the package?" And Oswald said, "Oh, don't you remember? Those are those curtain rods that I came out to get." And that explanation, tragically, satisfied Frazier completely, and the conversation drifted off to the weather and the kids that both families had. Frazier drove Oswald into the Texas School Book Depository area. It was raining, but the rain was starting to subside. And when they stopped, Frazier had some difficulty turning off the car properly. And Oswald took the opportunity to jump out of the car and walk towards the Texas School Book Depository with his package separately, something he had never done before. On the trips back to the depository, Frazier and Oswald had always walked together to the depository building. But this time, Oswald was at least 30 feet in front of Frazier the entire time. Frazier thought that was somewhat odd, but again, Frazier, ever agreeable, said nothing about it. By the time Frazier got into the building, Oswald was nowhere in sight. So far ahead of Frazier had he been. Oswald was undoubtedly on his way to the sixth floor to secret his package in a faraway corner, surrounded by boxes, or soon to be surrounded by boxes, until the rifle would be usable sometime after noon that day. The evidence against Oswald accumulated exponentially between his time that morning and his flight from the depository after the assassination at 12:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Oswald wedged his clipboard between some boxes before his departure from the building 3 minutes after the assassination. The clipboard was discovered the first week in December. That, and the fact that he filled no orders at all that morning, makes no sense if he was innocent. Oswald was last seen on the sixth floor by several of his co-workers who were also on that floor. As they said goodbye to him, they prepared to go down to a lower floor, and Oswald asked them to send the elevator back up to the sixth floor because he told them he would go down in a few minutes. He told his co-workers that he would come down. However, no one reported seeing Oswald at all thereafter, suggesting that he did not come down. Now we enter into the world of what-ifs. About noon, Bonnie Ray Williams took his chicken lunch up to the sixth floor and ate it at the center window, just yards away from the southeast corner window, where Oswald was crouching silently. Williams could not see Oswald because the corner was surrounded by book boxes as high as a human being. Of course, Oswald had surrounded his sniper's nest with those boxes. Around 12:10 p.m., just seconds before JFK was scheduled to pass by, Williams finished his lunch and decided to go down to the fifth floor, where he knew his friends Harold Norman and Junior Garman were watching the motorcade. Oswald must have been cringing in frustration while Williams ate his lunch. But JFK was late, and Oswald had time to use the dime that he would later use to purchase a Coke with to assemble his rifle around 12:15. He was ready by 12:25, with at least 5 minutes to spare. In our next podcast episode, to be released on March 25th, we will see what happened next and what incriminated Oswald in the hour and 15 minutes that followed, leading to his arrest at 1:50 p.m. Central Standard Time in the suburb of Oak Cliff. That's it for today's episode of AudiblySpeaking.com. New podcast episodes appear on audiblyspeaking.com approximately once every 2 weeks. Please subscribe to Audibly Speaking on iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator you enjoy. Until next time, this is Rick Ryman. Happy listening!